Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Today's episode features Megan Kingham. From nursing to OH&S to starting the first national corporate health and wellbeing program at AGL, Megan Kingham is now the Director of Staff Health, People and Culture at New South Wales Ambulance. In this episode, we talk about mental health and wellbeing strategies at a corporate level and how starting a big new role at New South Wales Ambulance just before COVID struck saw Megan learn fast adaptability. An insightful and interesting episode. Welcome, Megan. Megan Kingham, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your insights, your story, your journey, and some fascinating things, I'm sure, with our listeners. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Megan, we want to dive into everything you're doing at the moment with New South Wales Ambulance, but what we want to do is go back further than that. Let's go back to what made you want to get into the health and wellbeing space in the first place, because you've been involved in it for around 20 odd years, and I'd be keen to see what made you get into it and where did you start with it?
Okay, well, like most things in my career, it's sort of, I fell into it.
Yes.
So many moons ago, I was a registered nurse. That was, I did my nursing training when I left school. And then...
Whereabouts was that?
Oh, I trained at the Children's Hospital in Camperdown.
Oh,
Sydney.
Okay, perfect.
So it was ages ago. And that was fine, although I did realise that I actually didn't want to do hospital-based nursing for the rest of my life. It looked back-breaking and exhausting. I remember when I was about 25 thinking, and they were women at the time, they looked so tired. And they were probably about 40, but I thought they were 100.
Wow.
And I just thought, I don't know if this is for me long-term. And so after I'd travelled and done all the usual things, I came back and I studied postgrad occ health and safety with an occ health nursing component. So back in those days, there was a lot of nurses in industry, you know, that are sort of old fashioned occupational health nurse. And so I started in that and I really liked it. And what I liked about it particularly was the preventative aspect. So that workplaces are a great forum for health promotion and preventative healthcare. And so rather than fixing people when they're broken, although there was an element of that as well, it was a fantastic opportunity to do some preventative stuff based around occ health and safety. I never liked the safety very much.
Right.
But I loved the health part. Yeah. So from there, I was fortunate enough to work for AGL, the energy company, and I had a great mentor and she coached me through and I followed the H part of OH&S. And then at AGL, I had the opportunity to start a wellbeing program.
Yes, so this is 2005, is that correct?
Yeah, 2005.
And so you introduced the first national corporate health and wellbeing program.
Yes, so AGL had moved from being a New South Wales company to being a national energy provider. And I had a boss who was very tolerant of my ideas. And I thought, why don't we do something in the wellbeing space and move away from, you know, manual handling and back injuries and that sort of stuff, and actually look at the whole person. And I pestered him long and hard until he said, look, all right, then just give it a go. I had no idea what I was doing.
How many staff were with AGL back then?
Oh, a few thousand?
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a few. And they were acquiring across the country. So it had to be national, had to be accessible. And there was nothing to copy.
No.
Because, you know, usually if you're looking to do something, you see who else is doing it. There was some Canadian work that was interesting. The Canadians are always pretty much ahead of the game in this. So I plagiarized something from Canada and started. And in 2005, you barely had an internet. Like it was.
Yeah. And this sort of foresight was, I mean, there wasn't much happening in the wellbeing space back then in corporates.
And it was a hard sell.
Yeah, was it really? Yeah. To leadership, you mean?
To leadership, because there was nothing to demonstrate the benefits.
Yes.
And it was seen as a bit fluffy.
Right.
And it probably was a little bit fluffy.
Okay.
Initially, it was yoga and fruit bowls.
Okay.
Which
nap
is
rooms,
fine. Yeah.
Meditation.
Yeah. Which is fine because you've got to start somewhere and then move towards some evidence base, like really start to, I think the challenge is then to measure the impact of what you're doing, because you can't just do it because it's nice and everybody likes it. Because that means it's easily disposed of, frankly.
And that can be the tough thing with wellbeing programs is the measurability. Everyone wants KPIs. Yeah. Everyone wants ROI. What's going on? How do we measure this? I mean, that would have been, even back in 2005, 6, 7, it would have been a struggle.
It was a struggle. ROI wasn't really asked for at that stage.
Okay.
But I could sense it was coming. That, you know, I was fortunate to be working for a company that supported this idea, but I knew eventually there would come a time where they'd say, well, why are we spending money on this? And so I think ROI is still something that's really difficult to deliver.
Yeah.
Health changes are long-term. Employees also aren't staying in organisations for a long time, so you can't actually measure an improvement in an employee's health if they're only with you for 2 years.
Yeah.
So I think at AGL and later when I moved on to Optus, where I was the manager of health and wellbeing, it very much became part of the employee experience. So part of being an employer of choice, you know, you want people to have a good time at work,
yeah,
and have some real benefits at work. So I guess there's how you sell it in, depends on the organisation. And Optus was very keen on the war for talent with Telstra, obviously. Yeah. So it's seen as part of that employee proposition. But at the same time, you can't just rely on that. You need to measure what you're doing as well. Because, you know, somebody from finance will ask.
Yes. It always comes up at some point.
It does.
So what were some of the challenges back then with AGL as you were implementing that first program? I mean, there would have been significant challenges, I'm sure, that you went through, but tell us a little bit about some of that.
I think getting the message out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we just had emails. Like there wasn't any of that sort of stuff that was available.
No video conferencing.
No, none of that. Yeah. So it was very much, we would send stuff out to every office, like in the post. Pedometers were the ones that you've put on your belt and dropped in the toilet. So all the sort of tech that we have now that, you know, being able to quantify our lives just wasn't available. So it was very much about that face-to-face stuff. It was healthy breakfasts. It was groups. It was on-site fitness.
Yes.
All those things that were actually in front of people's eyes, because that's how you had to do it. So, and regional and metro delivery, which is still a problem, of course. That was a real thing as well.
Yeah.
So you want a program that's accessible to everybody in the organisation, but you can't deliver the same thing to somebody in Broken Hill as and for somebody who's in the middle of Sydney. It's just not practical.
And I guess back then even it would have been a fine line between box ticking, like let's just, we want to be seen to be doing something, let's put the page up on the website, let's do this, tick some boxes and we move on, versus actually having that long-term, that holistic care for employees at that time. It would have been tough to...
Yeah, it was tough. And there was very much the view that an employee life is none of our business.
Yes, 9 to 5.
So, yeah, 9 to 5. They come in here, they work for us and they go home. And what is, you know, impacting them from home? None of our business.
Yes.
So there's that. And I think that started to shift. And I mean, it's shifted exponentially now over the last 3 years,
of course,
that recognizing that you've got a whole person walking through the door.
Yes.
But I think also then that the boundaries still need to be clear. You've got a whole person walking through the door, but you are not, as an employer, there to fix for them as well. You know,
yes.
It's a difficult balance, I think.
And so looking back at your time with AGL, would the implementation of that plan be the thing you're most proud of with that, following it through?
Yeah, I think so.
Showing the benefits.
Yes, and just embedding it.
Yeah.
And I think, I am very proud of it, actually.
Because it would have been a fair bit of stigma back then too.
Around mental health?
Mental health. Oh, yeah. Talking about it.
Yeah.
Being seen to be using, benefiting from the services.
Yeah. And I must admit our mental health aspect of it was a bit light on. We recognised it as a thing.
Yeah.
You know, the pillars of well-being, we had physical, mental, emotional, spiritual.
Yes.
But our offerings were pretty slim. You know, we had an EAP. But you could only, it was about stigma reduction then. Yeah. But what I love over the last 20 years is how that's developed. Not only the recognition and not only the help seeking that people do now, but also what's available. Sometimes too much, I think. It's really hard as a practitioner in this space to decide what you should use, what tool you should use, what program you should provide, because there's a million of them.
Yes. Yeah, and it can confuse people when they're trying to get some help seeking services and see where they need to go.
Mm.
Navigating the systems can be quite tough.
Yeah, because it's individually based. You can't roll out the same thing for everybody.
No.
And so I find it confusing. So I'm not surprised that
the
general population finds it confusing.
So you went from working with AGL, then you did some time doing going to tertiaries, private enterprise.
Yes, I decided to work for myself, which was interesting because it was the GFC, so not great.
Wow.
I did a whole variety. I had a portfolio career at that stage.
Right.
I was working in a clothes shop. I was a marriage celebrant. I was doing ergonomics. I did a bit of everything.
Yep.
But I kept my hand in and I helped set up the wellbeing program at UTS in Sydney. I did some training work, a whole lot of things. And then I decided that I liked being employed full time. So I applied for the manager of health and wellbeing at Optus. And I was there for 6.5 years.
Okay. And how did you find that experience?
Oh, I loved it. It was so good.
Things were a bit more developed by that time?
A bit more developed. So that was 2012.
Okay.
So health and wellbeing, can't say it. Health and wellbeing had come a long way.
Yes.
The tech had come a long way. Comms had come a long way. And there was a recognition that it was an expected offering from a large employer. And as I said before, Optus war for talent with Telstra and other telcos. You want to stand apart. And so that was one of the reasons that they established it. So I had the good fortune of building from the ground up again, like setting up a program. And it was wonderful. It was a really good experience.
It's interesting to see that shift at that point in time where companies, corporates or whatever, they went from just having it as a nice to have, we've got to have a policy, we've got to make sure we're seen to be covering this and that. And then all of a sudden now turning the tide, and even these days it still seems to be a little bit that way, to have it as a weapon, but to have it as an advantage, a point of difference to your competition, to attract talent, to keep talent. And so all of a sudden it's gone from just covering the basics to let's tick the boxes a little bit and we'll do this. But to then saying, well, hang on, it's a holistic view. What else can we do with them? Mm. What else can we help support them so that the time that they're at work is healthy, is beneficial, the whole family, all of a sudden now we're starting to look including more than just the employee.
Mm-hmm.
So is that what that would have been about that time?
It was about that time. And I think that employer of choice stuff became really important. And I sometimes think about the health and wellbeing offerings at a corporate, for example. It's a bit like when you're going on holidays and you look at all the hotels where you could stay and there's the one with all the list of stuff.
Mm.
You know, it's got the massage, it's got the and you maybe, you tend to pick that one because it's got all this stuff. Now, you may not use any of that stuff when you're there, but you pick it because they've got it.
There's so many options.
It's attractive, right? And I think not everybody who comes to work at an organisation is going to use all their wellbeing offering, but they love that they exist and,
Yeah, and you're probably seeing that even though they might be possibly paying less in some instances now, but the benefits are better.
Yeah.
Could it in fact be the deciding factor?
It could be. And I think organisations that have a lot of on-site stuff now, it's about convenience, although with people working from home more and more, I think time-poor employees, if you can do things to make their working life a little bit easier, then it makes all the difference.
So Megan, January 2020, you were then put in the position with Ambulance New South Wales as the correct role is the Director of Staff Health. Is that what the
That's
title
right.
was? Yep, is.
So I left Optus and dabbled for a year working for a startup, which didn't start up.
Yes.
And that was an eye-opener. I have enormous sympathy for people in startups.
In the tech space or?
Yeah, it was in the tech space. So
it's risky, isn't it?
So risky.
It's so hard to get off the ground.
And on paper, it looks like, we'll just do this and we'll just do this. Oh, it's awful. And finding funding and anyway, I decided that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And so the director of staff health role came up at New South Wales Ambulance and I thought, oh, they'd be decent to work for. And it was one of those cases where I sort of just applied and thought, whatever. I don't think they'll, you know, I've got too much experience in the private sector. They'll be looking for somebody with, government experience. And then I got the job.
Wow.
Because I think they were looking for somebody with external views. So
there's so much value in that, though, from getting someone from outside the system to come in and look at it. I think it's such a benefit.
It is. It is. Because you do, you get, what's the word? I don't know what the word is, but yeah, you know, it is.
Different perspective.
Different perspective. And if you're in an organisation for a long time,
yes,
you do tend to, you know, lose that view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You look through a very tight lens.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very narrow focus, possibly. So what was it like when you first joined January 2020? Was it terrifying? Was it?
It was. I'd come into the public sector for the first time since I'd been a nurse a million years ago, and the state was on fire, and it was sort of all hands on deck, like this, and this. I couldn't understand the language. There were acronyms that just went on forever. And I thought, okay. And the team was relatively new. New South Wales Ambulance we were fortunate enough to get a lot of funding a few years ago and set up this broader health and wellbeing team. So psychologists had been onboarded. There was a whole lot of new recruits. And as a team, a lot of the components hadn't worked together before. So I had a new team, stayed on fire. And I'd never worked in the public sector before. So I actually.
Was there an established framework?
No.
Okay.
So we didn't have a strategy either.
Wow.
So
you pretty much had a clean slate.
Clean slate and, you know, and ongoing nausea. It was just, I was terrified that I was just going to fail.
Yeah.
But fortunately, my team is amazing.
Yes.
And when I had to go to my first senior management meeting and report on something that I didn't even know what it meant, they were very supportive. And it would look, also, it is a very supportive organisation. And I think one of the things is that in a situation like that, you don't know what normal is, which can be actually a good thing. You can, I think, processes get changed, adapted, whatever, to suit the situation. And that can often be an innovation in itself. So we went from state on fire straight into COVID and then into floods and then now.
Yes.
So it's been an interesting, it's the hardest job I've ever had and it's wonderful at the same time.
Yeah. Well, that's where the growth is coming from and probably that challenge would be really quite satisfying when you're getting through them.
It is. When I think about it, sometimes my brain hurts and I get a nervous tick because I think, oh my goodness. But really, I've learned an enormous amount.
So you were terrified of the role, and this is before COVID came along.
Mm-hmm.
And then COVID came along 2 months in.
Yeah.
There was no established framework.
Everything was on the fly.
Reactive.
Yep.
What was that like? I mean, how did you sleep at night?
I didn't very well. I slept because I was exhausted, but I'm not a paramedic. I mean, the paramedics were extraordinary. They had to adapt to new procedures, it seemed like every minute. You know, wearing more and more PPE, that connection to patients, the fear for themselves, the fear for their families. And now I think, I mean, when you think back on it, don't you find it extraordinary that we did what we did? Like as a community, not just paramedics, but
yes,
as Australians, I think back on it now and just can't quite believe it.
You never would have imagined in your life that they would have had a border between states that you would have been forced to stay at home. Like you just,
it's weird.
None of us have ever had to deal with that ever in our lives. And for someone to come and say that this will happen next year you'd laugh at them and say, no, sorry.
Same rubbish. Yeah. And we had staff living on one side of the border and working. So we've got staff in Queensland, live in Queensland, work in New South Wales, live in Victoria, work in New South Wales. So that, I don't even know how the people who were trying to do the rostering around that, it was just crazy.
Yeah.
So when I think back on it, I just find it so extraordinary from every aspect. And delivering things remotely, like not seeing people, I think for such a face-to-face organisation, and that means not only with each other as employees, but face-to-face with our patients. And, you know, as a paramedic, you go into a house and you've got the face shield on and the gown and the guy. Like, it's awful for a profession that is so connected literally to their patients, to their customers, touching them, talking to them, and all those barriers to be put in place. It's just awful.
So what happened? I mean, so you went in there, there was no framework, there was no existing structure in place for well-being and employee health and well-being. Where did you start from? Because COVID came along, you'd be almost, I know you said you were reactive, but did you set up, how did it work? Did you set up some committees, some teams for feedback on what you actually wanted, what they wanted to design the program? Did you bring what you used with AGL and Optus?
Yeah.
And
so one of the first things we needed to do was develop a strategy. Now, couldn't be that consultative because nobody had the time.
Mm.
I mean, we consulted as best we could, but everybody was flat out. If they were, and then people were sick and all that sort of stuff. So a lot of that BAU stuff got pushed to the back.
Yep.
But fortunately, we knew that we wanted a health and wellbeing strategy that covered both physical and mental health. We weren't going to have a separate mental health strategy because I think that has some issues. It means that it is seen as separate from physical health, and it's not.
Right.
So fortunately, again, this great team I have helped put a strategy together. And the other thing that we really wanted to focus on was the fact that it was person-centered.
Yes.
So very much following best practice about you don't necessarily roll out something, the same thing for everybody. You may have, the intent may be the same, but sometimes the delivery is different. And what people need is different, particularly if they've been exposed to trauma, then you need to recognise that, or we needed to recognise that it's not a one-size-fits-all. So, and I think in that first year, we were able to set that strategy as a 5-year strategy, and we can stick to that going forward. And it's not prescriptive for it to be derailed by anything. Our intent is that we have an individual-centred program. That's the main intent of it. So we can do that regardless of what happens.
And no matter where they are, they have access to
similar
opportunities and services. Yeah.
And that equity of service is really difficult.
Yeah. So, I mean, with that, did you see a rise in, like, what were some of the patterns you were seeing in the workforce, from the workforce over that COVID time? Was it trauma? Was it PTSD? A bit of high reports of anxiety amongst the staff? Was there? I'd be interested and fascinated to find out.
I think higher levels of fear and anxiety, just like the rest of the community. But I think for the first time, or maybe not for the first time, but it seemed like the first time, a real fear of what you do at work, you can literally take it home to your family. So a lot of anxiety around that. So particularly when it came to vaccination status, you know, all the furore around vaccinations. I remember one of our paramedics doing a press conference saying, please get vaccinated because it's, you know, I don't want to take this home to my family. It was a very powerful press conference. So that real fear of that, I think, for the first time. Because paramedics are good with trauma. They expect trauma in their lives, but this and I'm not saying they're not affected by it, but trauma is not unexpected as a paramedic. But this, I think that the cloud of what I do at work, I could literally take home and impact my family, make my family unwell.
Yeah.
So, and family anxiety as well. And particularly when, you know, we were isolating people with COVID.
Yeah.
You know, that Remember in the beginning where people were sort of locked in their bedrooms,
yeah,
and put them in hotels and all that sort of stuff. So all the stuff about that and the impact on families. We have a family support network as part of the staff health offering, and recognising that families are often the ones who will recognise the signs in their loved one of things not being quite right. So how do families know what to do? So that.
So the educational side of things.
Psychoeducation for families, yeah.
Yeah. So is that something you rolled out across?
Yes. So the family support network is in 2020 as well, which wasn't ideal. We had grand plans for doing all these family events, and of course we couldn't do any of them.
Yeah.
So, but the main purpose of that is to support family.
Yeah.
And to help them, again, recognise what's going on for their loved one who works for ambulance and know what to do and know what support's available.
So as you go through COVID and the organisation goes through COVID, and I mean, first responders are allowed to continue their service, obviously, and rightly so, they had to be out there on the front line. Was there a noticeable increase in reports of anxiety across people? Is there a statistic or something that they reported? Is there anything around that that you think as an organisation saw a bit of a spike?
We do have, there has been a trend, an upward trend in psychological claims as far as our workers' comp stats go. I can't speak to those because it's not in my area, but generally, and I think it's across the board in a lot of organisations, that there is an increase in psychological claims as opposed to physical claims. So certainly, yes, we did see an increase.
And so what were some of your key learnings with the policy or with the framework that you looked to implement with Ambulance New South Wales as you went through COVID and then coming out of COVID? Because I imagine there would be a few adjustments and additional things made coming out of it.
I think one of the things that we're adjusting to post-COVID, and we have a strategy, an organisation-wide strategy called The Next Normal, which focuses on what happens now. Like, we can't say COVID's over and we all go back to normal because it's not over, and we won't go back to how things were before. So how do we look after our workforce going forward in that, recognising that they need to reconnect? So reconnect with community, reconnect with their professional development. So all this, reconnect with their family. You know, get to take all that leave that nobody could take over COVID, all those sorts of things we need to look at as part of overall wellbeing. Also hearing their stories. So part of moving on from the crisis is to actually recognise what people went through. I think people need an avenue for that, to tell their stories, to be recognised for what they did. So that's part of the Next Normal strategy. And then things like, initially, fear of reintegration into the community. So, you know, people didn't necessarily want to come back into the office. So if you think, not only, paramedics never have the luxury of working from home, but the corporate side did, and there were some fears of coming back in. People were really scared. Mm. They didn't necessarily want to be in offices with other people. So those sorts of things needed to be addressed. I think people rethought their working lives over that time. So if they have decided to take another path, how can we help them exit the organisation with some dignity and respect? But if they are staying, then how can we reconnect them with every part of the organisation?
Yeah. Did you find there's over 7,000 employees with Ambulance New South Wales.
Yeah.
Did we find that went up quite a bit during recruiting new people? You had some fall away, obviously.
Had some fall away. We've had a huge injection of funds to increase our on-road staff.
Yeah.
So it's last year and is taking 4 years. So there has been, because it was quite obvious during COVID that we didn't have enough people.
Yes.
Yeah. And also, fortunately, some of that funding is going to cover sort of back of house staff, like the staff health team, because we can't take on a whole lot of new people and expect to support them with the same amount of people that we have now.
No.
So there's a huge upsurge in staffing numbers.
And if you look at where things are heading with your role and the direction that you're taking with it, I mean, are you excited? What excites you most about it? And what cool things do you have coming up?
What excites me most? What excites me most is I think the team and I learn something every day. Right. Like it's no day is the same, and we have increased capability to respond to whatever comes up. So one of the things that we did recognise over the last couple of years is that we really do need to focus on the individual-centred way we deliver our care, and that the days of role, you know, this happens to somebody or this happens to a group of people and we roll out the same program for them and that's everything. So we do really have to recognise that individuals are different. I mean, I know that sounds trite, but sometimes that's not seen. It's seen as a group of employees and this is what they will get. I think in the health and wellbeing space, you need to be really mindful that everybody is different. I think also we need to be mindful of what is best practice, particularly in the psychological space, and also be mindful of how we're measuring what we're doing. So measurement, as I said at the beginning, is hard, but it's important and it's something that you can't lose focus of. So we are increasingly measuring what we're doing and how it impacts on people.
Yeah.
So that doesn't sound very exciting, but it is.
I think it's, I mean, you get to see, you know, the change that you make in people's lives and to employ policy and frameworks that it can actually provide better outcomes for staff from, and that's, I mean, you can't put a price on that sort of stuff.
And we get to do good things for good people.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you're right.
Much better than that.
No. I just want to also touch on, I mean, are there certain things you're doing now in the induction process, the training process to promote that health and wellbeing, to talk about it, to reduce the stigma, to create that awareness and education around the trauma piece certainly, but also, you know, other links to mental illness?
I think one of the things we've been fortunate to be having over the last few years is a wellbeing workshop, which is 2 to 3 days, and every employee goes to that.
Wow.
And that has some components about being well at work, safe at work, and protected at work. So from my team's point of view, the well at work aspect, we do body fit and mind fit. So it gives people a whole lot of tools. So it's more preventative, right?
Yep.
Rather than waiting for the wheels to fall off when we help you, we actually give you all these tools to help you manage yourself and manage your reactions. The challenge for that is people get it at the beginning, then how do you keep it front of mind? You know, at induction, you know, you take everything in, it's all great. 2 years later, yeah, you might not remember. But I think it is about reminding people of the stuff that's available, reminding them of the tools that they've been given for self-care. And that goes towards a preventative approach, because we can't fix everything for everybody. And giving them the tools to look after themselves is a valuable foundation. But we need to remind people all the time of what's in their toolbox.
Yep.
And that's the thing, you're almost re-recruiting your employees for the entire time they're with your organisation. You can't forget. You can't sort of set and forget and go, well, we told you this when you started.
Yeah.
And 10 years later, we don't bother. I mean, you have to just keep on with a common language, common message, and evidence-based.
Yes. And what about post-service? Is there some fascinating things happening? Is there something going on in that area as well to look after people beyond their service?
We are currently, so I think ambulance is moving away from people having a job for life. I mean, and that's, again, across the employment.
Yeah, it's in every
situation in Australia is people don't stay for as long as they used to. So, but they may come back. So we want them to have, I mean, part of having a good health and wellbeing program is that you want people to have a positive experience while they're working for you. So that if they get a chance to come back, they'll go, oh, yeah, that's right. I'd like to go back there. That was good.
Yeah.
You know, it was a good working life for me. But also we've got to recognise that people will leave and not come back, and we need to help them exit the organisation with some dignity and respect, as I said before. And I think for an organisation that has had a rusted-on workforce in the past, doing that is a bit of a shift. So we've got a pilot going with Fortum Australia on transition to other employment or retirement, where we help people do that and just help them to have, because, you know, retirement isn't about more than how much super you've got. And also going to another job, I think paramedics often don't recognise how transferable their skills are. So we need to help facilitate a dignified and respectful exit.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, some of the people who have engaged with this program have actually thought they wanted to leave, and after a while on the program have actually re-engaged with the organization and decided to stay.
Wow.
Which is quite good.
That's right? Great.
Yeah. So that's a really exciting thing, I think.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good.
It's, I mean, employees saved. I mean, it just, it'd be certain cost savings with that as well.
Yeah, turnover is expensive.
It is. It is expensive. So, Megan, as the last question I want to ask, moving forward, what's going to happen? What's happening with you? And, yeah, what exciting things you got coming up?
What's happening with me? Well, I'm taking a breath after the last 3 years, and I'm quite enjoying it. And the staff health team is getting to do some less reactive work, some substantial preventative stuff, and we've got the space to actually think about what is going to happen in the next couple of years. I'm very excited the way that we're starting to track our employee exposure to potentially traumatic events. So that's one of the things that's been difficult in the past, tracking, you know, how many events that are potentially traumatic our people are exposed to, and being able to intervene early so it's not, you know, way down the track when things are a bit wobbly that we go in. We need to be able to sort of track their exposure so we can intervene early. That's a really exciting project for us. And we've worked with Phoenix Australia on best practice around that. So that's very exciting. Our health and fitness team's doing some great work. Our family support network is amazing. We've set up a domestic violence referral officer network within ambulance, which is proving sadly to be highly used. Mm-hmm. So that's just helping people gate the internal processes around what's available to you if you're a victim of domestic or family violence. We've got a robust peer support network. We've got a really strong chaplaincy. We've got everything. It's great. It's really, really exciting.
So being a bit more intentional, getting time to actually, be proactive with it all.
Yeah.
And I think it's exciting. It's an exciting time then. So
it is exciting. And look, the lessons we learned from COVID around delivery of stuff have been very valuable, although we can't underestimate the value of a face-to-face interaction with a health professional. It makes all the difference. But yeah, we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot.
Megan, if people want to get a hold of you or get in touch to find out more, what's the best way they can get in touch with you?
They can just drop me a line at megan.kingham@health.newsouthwales.gov.au. I'd be happy to chat.
That sounds really good. I think it's been really insightful to hear not only your journey throughout your career so far, but the amazing things that you've been up to, certainly with Ambulance New South Wales, certainly getting thrown in the hot seat there during COVID, and then going through the floods and whatnot. I mean, it's like you said, it was reactive to start, but now you're finding a bit of time to really try and make a more intentional structure and framework, which is exciting, and everyone's benefiting. So I mean, it sounds really good, and keep up the good work.
Thanks. I'm very lucky.
Thanks so much, Megan.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.